So I saw an Instagram video yesterday where a dad was talking about his two-year-old, and he's going, I just don't know what happened. She seems like she is the ruler of all of us. She's just so bossy. And then it cut to a video of him, and he had their baby, maybe when she was like 5 or 6 months, on his shoulder, and everyone around him is chanting, all hail the queen. All hail the queen. So it was a good learning lesson. Be careful what you start early. Now, the idea of having a king or a queen, it's been the norm through so much of history. I've been watching the new Ken Burns documentary on the American Revolution, and it's so fascinating that they start out and they essentially say, this is the first time in history where people have been able to elect the person who governs them instead of having someone who has been chosen by God or has military power. You see, when we expect something to be a certain way, it's hard to imagine that things could be different. And it was very clear that the British ruling class and the king did not think America's idea of being a republic was going to make it. And that is also to be determined, I suppose. But today is Christ the King Sunday. And talking about Jesus as king, that's something that can make us feel weird and make us flinch. We don't like the idea of a king with unlimited ruling power, especially as proud Americans who idolize democracy. And we might even ask, why on earth would we call Jesus a king? So today we're going to do another little history journey. We're going to take it back to the origins of kingship and religion. The Israelites, the tribes of Israel, and how they received a king. You see, the idea of a king gets kind of romanticized over time for the Israelite people, the Jewish people in Jesus' day. And by the time that Jesus comes onto the scene, the people are longing for a king, somebody who will have lots of power and military power, so that they can return to being free and independent from the Roman Empire. There's a certain nostalgia for the Jewish people that at Jesus' time was really relevant, that they wanted a king because of their most widely known king, who is, of course, David. Come on, guys. David, the other two services got it. I don't know what you guys are doing. And there's nostalgia around the Davidic times because it's when Israel was independent, they had a king. Things weren't perfect, but they were pretty good. The folks who write about David in the Old Testament, some of them are honest about his deficiencies, but a lot of it is to lift up David and in turn lift up the nation of the Israelites, showing that they are capable of following God, of gaining power, of prospering. But after David is king, things slowly start to fall apart. The Israelites split apart into the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom over a fight about taxes. Sound familiar? Each has their own king, and then over the next 500 years, various kings fall away in different ways from God. They worship other gods, and the people move further and further away from their original calling, which is that they are blessed to be a blessing to others. And that leads us to the end of the Davidic kings and the Babylonian exile in the year 586 BC. After that, no more independence, no more kings in the line of David. Now, David is not the first king of Israel, though. The first king is, of course, Saul. Whoever said that not very confidently, you did. Was that you, Nancy? No. Well, it was Susan. Good job, Susan. And Nancy should have answered. She's in Bible study. But Saul becomes king when he's anointed by the prophet Samuel. And that's where I really want to take us back to. So here's what happens in the 8th chapter of 1 Samuel. Samuel the prophet, who is essentially the leader of all the tribes of Israel, is in consultation with God, but he's kind of getting up there in years. And the people come to him and they say, "Hey Samuel, you're kind of old, and your sons, not that great. So we've been thinking, and we'd like to have a king, because the other nations around us, they've got a lot of power, and they have kings. So we think we'd like to do that." So Samuel goes, and he talks to God. And God laments, because God sees the people as desiring a king to replace their reliance on God. Then God tells Samuel to warn the people. So Samuel gets up, and he says, "Listen, everyone, if you have a king is going to take your sons. He's going to put them in the military. He's going to take your harvest from you. He's going to make your daughters work for him. He's really going to take everything that you value, the best of everything that you own. And one day, you're going to be fed up." So Samuel essentially tells them, "A king will always disappoint you. A king won't look out for your best interest. So no matter how much you succeed with power and might, a king will never love and lead you the way that God does." And the people respond, "Thanks, Samuel, but we still want a king. We want to be powerful like those other nations." So from the beginning, a human king is not the answer to the people's problems. And those kings do cause problems. So much so that God raises up prophets to call out the kings, to warn them about not following the commandments. But like I said earlier, it all comes to an end during the Babylonian exile. They'll never not be under the rule of an empire again. They'll never be able to independently govern themselves. And that also means no more kings in the line of David. There are no more who are anointed, which means Messiah. There's no one who comes forward in the line of David for about 500 years, until we come to one man who traces his ancestry back to David. And that man is, of course, yes. Good job, everyone. You got it. Jesus, who is often called the Messiah. And here in our text for today, we meet Jesus at the end of his short life. He's hung on the cross next to criminals. He's abused, he's mocked, he's jeered at. And finally, a sign is placed over his head that reads, "The King of the Jews." Seems like a pretty lowly death for a king. Seems like it would be a huge disappointment for those who sought a king that would bring military and political power. And yet we sit here today, we sing about it, we read about it, we proclaim Jesus Christ is the King. So what does that even mean? Now, we've had a history lesson. We're going to look a little bit at theology today, too. It's a big day. Martin Luther, the Lutheran namesake, back in the 1500s, he wrote a lot of stuff, but this is some of his best stuff, in my opinion. The way that he talked about how Jesus is king. Luther was very against the idea, which he called theology of glory. Essentially, this means when we talk about God, we uplift the power of God and God's achievements. We might say, "God helped us win this war," or "God blessed us with wealth," or "Wow, I'm so good that God gave me lots and lots of children." As humans, if we follow the theology of glory, we elevate kind of our own achievements, our good works, because That's what we see as the goal of our faith. So if we fail, that means that God's not on our side. The cross then becomes just kind of the stepping stone to eternal life. It's kind of just a hiccup on the way. We'd really rather sweep it under the rug because it's ugly. And so instead of the theology of glory, Martin Luther saw God's presence in Jesus through the theology of the cross. In his theology, the cross is not just a blip, but it's the most important way that God is revealed. God's presence is made known in the weakness and the suffering. God is not only willing to become human through Jesus, but God's willing to die a pitiful and painful death. God's willing to enter the reality of human suffering at the worst. And in the middle of that suffering and evil, God proclaims grace and forgiveness. The unexpected lowliness of Jesus' death mirrors the unexpected nature of Jesus' ministry. Instead of to the mighty and powerful, Jesus' calling is to serve the least of these, the sick, the suffering, the poor, the outcast. God is found in the place where glory is not found. Now, when we look back at the times of the kings and the expectations of the people in having a king, the Old Testament does a lot of theology of glory. It points to human success as God-sanctioned success. If we win a war, God's on our side. But the opposite is true, too. If we get thrown into exile, kicked out of our homeland, that means God's abandoned us. But what Jesus teaches us is that God does not abandon us in our worst times. When death and suffering take place, God enters in. So what does that mean for us if we call Jesus our King? To me, it seems very clear that Jesus as a king is completely different than what we expect a worldly ruler as a king to be. And it's completely different than what the people expected to happen. When worldly leaders seek power, Jesus offers service. He kneels at the feet of his friends and he washes their feet. When worldly leaders covet wealth, Jesus says, "Give everything away." He tells his disciples, "Take only the clothes on your back. Rely on the community for hospitality." When worldly leaders tell us that there's not enough, Jesus creates abundance. Out of 2 loaves and 5 fish, he feeds a hungry multitude. And when worldly leaders proclaim military might, Jesus proclaims peace. In the midst of violence, at the time of death on a cross, he says, "Father, forgive them." So if this is Jesus, and if Jesus is our King, how will we be his subjects?